You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm bringing you, I'm sorry about this, there were some sound issues with it that we took a long time to clear up. It wasn't my highest priority, and I apologise to Andrew and to you, but this was recorded live at the Leamington Spa Comedy Festival last year in, I'm going to say October, so it has been a while. This is a fascinating interview with a very unusual man and a very unusual comedian, the brilliant Andrew O'Neill. For people listening at home, or maybe there are people here who don't know what it is that you do or what you look like, you have several looks.
Yeah.
And you're in a more boy-y one tonight.
Yeah. So, but yes, technically not, but yes.
Yeah.
I know it's a minefield.
Well, let's imagine, I always like to imagine that a listener in a country that you've never visited, who's never seen you before, just yeah. Describe what you look like, what you do, what your act is.
I'm currently looking like a metalhead. I've got a band shirt, skinny jeans, bullet belt, shiny DMs, and I've got long hair and tattoos. I was about to number them, and I can't remember how many I've got now.
They're
merging into one.
The one that I always remember is you have a tattoo of the seal of Rassilon.
I do, yeah.
So if anyone who, out there knows what that means, it's like a shibboleth, isn't it?
That's
if you know
perfect.
What that is,
yeah.
It's that. So, okay, and what's the meat of your act? What sort of comedy do you do?
I think the one word I would go for would be silly.
Okay.
That's pretty much my target above all. But when I was growing up and was a massive comedy nerd, and I had really Catholic tastes in comedy. I like pretty much like anything that was comedy. So whether that was Smith and Jones or Monty Python or Blackadder, pretty much anything that was comedy. Bobby Davro, you know, anything like that. All the really crap ITV stuff. You know, I hoovered it all up, and then I wanted to be like a sketch comic because I was obsessed with Python. And then I saw Eddie Izzard doing sketch comedy in the form of stand-up. I went, oh, I can be a stand-up. There were other parallels with Izzard as well, but
sure.
I thought then I want. But then I couldn't decide whether I wanted to be more like him or Harry Hill or Bill Bailey or Bill Hicks. And so I decided I would basically not focus on a style, but write each joke on its individual merits and
okay.
then just run them all together.
Okay.
So initially it was really clear when I was doing it, an Eddie Izzard bit or a Harry Hill bit or a Bill Bailey bit or a Monty Python bit. And hopefully now I've mixed that up enough that it's...
You've disguised it as your own creation.
I've slightly disguised it as my own creation. So in terms of, so that's why what style I do songs and I do illustrate little sketches and I do some sort of political stuff, more personally political now. But then the idea is I run it all together, and when I'm ordering my set, they all have to be sort of riffle shuffled together
mm-hmm.
in order that if I'm doing too much silly stuff and then too much straight stuff, it feels weird.
Okay, so you like to have a big mix of different styles within an hour.
Yeah, and it's sort of, it began consciously, and now it's completely just how I write comedy anyway, so
okay.
I just like, basically anything I can think of that's genuinely funny will go in. and I just have to find a place for it.
Okay. And your the show I was listening to on the way up, which is available on YouTube, is called Occult Comedian.
Yeah.
And I never know where the stress goes in that word. Is it occult or occult?
I usually go for occult because the idea was a pun on cult comedian.
Lovely.
But with magic stuff, basically there are a load of people that tell you you're pronouncing it wrong, and they're idiots because there's no right way to pronounce it anyway.
Okay. So. Like Latin. Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. Like Latin. Yeah.
Okay. So you're just to sort of complete the picture, the you've done a show called Heavy Metal, a History of Heavy Metal.
Yeah.
You've done Occult Comedian.
Yeah.
You look like a kind of, you've got a huge tattoo of a, I'm assuming it's a kraken.
It's Cthulhu.
Oh, it's Cthulhu. Okay. Yeah. So he not a kraken.
No, sort of.
A bit crackish.
Yeah, it's crackenish. It's definitely crackenish. It's crackenesque, yeah.
Yeah. And in your show, in the Occult Comedian show, and we'll start with that one because it's fresh in my mind, but you talk about the fact that you practice magic rituals, and you have a lovely moment when you talk about how you regard jokes as spells.
Absolutely.
That are like a ritual... Well, you explain it in
a joke is a spell to make people laugh. A joke is the single best example of magic. It's you write the right words, put them in the right order, you say them with the right tone of voice, with the correct conviction, in a situation that you have concocted to be as perfect as possible. So you've got lights on you, there's often music involved, everyone's sitting together like in a church or like in a ritual, and you say these jokes, and if they believe in you, the joke will work and it will cause a physical reaction in the real world. You're turning magic into, magic is essentially pretty much turning your will into something in the real world. And it's the line between kind of thought and language and the physical world.
I mean, I'm loving that this is getting very esoteric very early on, but that's fine.
Comedy is magic and pretty much magic is comedy. The way you sit and you know, literally write a spell. The words, if you get it wrong, the spell won't work.
So from the point of view of someone listening to this who is, say...
Rational.
what I want to do is sort of unpick which elements of this are metaphor and which of them do you actually mean as. When you say in your show, I practice magic, from your description in the show before, it sounds like what you call magic, other people might call visualization or NLP or something like that.
Yeah.
What are the differences between those two things and what you mean as magic?
Magic has more in the way of suspension of disbelief and more in the way of symbolism, I suppose. And NLP is kind of comes from a lot of magical practices.
This is neuro-linguistic programming for anyone that's not familiar with
it. The point at which my belief in magic escapes most skeptical people's grasp is I genuinely believe that in using magic you can tweak the probability of certain things happening. I'm not sure what the mechanism of that is, but having done magic and having seen the results to the degree that it takes the piss.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah. I'll give you two examples. The best example was I did a ritual, a day-long exercise to look for something. Look at the whole world as though the universe was desperately trying to tell you something. This is an exercise in expanding your magical consciousness. And I did it first in my house. And the first time you do it, you're supposed to do it alone. And you look around you. And so you look at the pattern in the window opposite you, the number of bricks in a chimney, you know, stuff like that. And it doesn't mean that there is magical meaning everywhere, but it also does because you put that meaning in. So you're looking at something and you inhabit it with your own consciousness and you make the magic happen in it. I did it at home, got nothing, was expecting results, didn't get results. What you're then supposed to do is go on a long, aimless journey. Instead of doing that, I went and did a gig. I was there with my wife and my sister-in-law, did the gig, not a huge amount happened at the gig. On the way home, I was telling them that I had done this exercise and hadn't really seen anything. There was loads of stuff I started noticing, like the number of magical words that are around everywhere, which doesn't mean that magic is real. It just means that magic has had an influence. So today's Friday, that's Frigg's Day, that's named after a Norse goddess. You know, the days of the week are magical. You know, an awful lot of our languages is influenced by magic. and esoteric stuff. So I noticed all this stuff didn't really mean anything. I then got on a night bus, the N29 night bus. I sat next to a sort of massive West African guy who was staring intently out the window. And he turned around to me and said, "Do you believe in God?" And I said, "Like, what? No." He goes, "Okay." And he looked out the window. I thought, oh, he's a God botherer and I've offended him. And he goes, "You don't believe in God?" I said, "No, sorry." He said, "What do you believe in?" And I said, "Well, you know, I believe that blah, 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 certain things, blah, 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 wishy-washy, blah, 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 you know." And then he said, "My name is Omen." Now, that's taking the piss already. If I'd made this story, if you'd put that story in a sitcom, people are going to go, "Well, yeah, all right."
Right, literally the day that you start doing this exercise, look, you meet a huge...
A guy called Omen. That's not a sign. Okay, right. And my brain is like, rationalise, this coincidence is fine. And then he said, "My name is Omen, 666, you know, 666. Why did my mother give me this name?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know." And he said, "But it could be a good thing, you know, Omen just means a sign." Oh, and that's when I made the connection. Because before then, I was just thinking Nutter on night bus.
So what you're saying is you try, as a magical experiment, you basically asked the universe for a sign.
Yeah.
And then hours later, someone walked up to you and said, "My name is Omen."
Yeah.
Okay.
And then tried to hand me a Celtic cross that had 666 in the knotwork and said, "This is for me, you have this." What he also said was, "You know when you're in the park and you tell a woman your name is Omen?" Tell me about it.
I mean, this happened in London.
There's
quite a lot of lunatics in London.
For sure.
And on night buses, one might surmise that's a more likely place to find...
Absolutely.
So, but you didn't believe it to be coincidence?
It starts to stretch my notion of what a coincidence is and something a little bit more significant is. Also, bear in mind, there were two witnesses to this story as well, my wife and her sister. They saw the whole thing.
Sure. No, I believe
that is also something that, you know, is worth adding to the story. And to this day, I don't put a huge amount of significance on that single event. I'm just like, that was cool, that was weird. You start to talk to people who take magic seriously and they go, yeah, exactly that sort of thing happens when anyone starts to take magic seriously.
Is that not in the same way that, and I don't know if I want to get into this bit yet, but let's do it. Go on, let's stay with it. Is that not in the same way that, say, and I know you're quite irreligious, anti-Christian in that show that you did in A Cult Comedian, you refer to Christians as retarded.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're very sort of staunchly anti-Christian or anti-religion. Do you not think that people who are Christian might have had similar sorts of experiences where they decided whether or not to believe something was a coincidence or something was a test of faith or whatever?
Yeah.
So what's the difference between your experience
and theirs? Because mine isn't a faith. This is my, basically what I have is a collection of experiences that I now put down to. Now I reckon that there's an ability to tweak the possibility of certain things happening.
But isn't the fact that you're using the word reckon there, isn't that like interchangeable with I believe that?
No, because religion is faith first and then you put everything together. All this stuff changed my mind. And I still now, when I hear 99.9% of anyone telling me I did magic and this happened, I went, yeah, that's not really how that works. Also, in the year I did A Cult Comedian in Edinburgh, me and my friend Al did a show called Andrew O'Neill's Probably Massively Inadvisable Occult Experiments, in which we got a group of people to do almost exactly the same thing I did, but we did a load of ritual stuff in it. And people told, and we said, just go away, go into the world, and within 24 hours, something will happen. Tell us what happened. And some of it was really, really cool, like a guy who'd lost all his money and was massively hungry, couldn't afford food. Someone had put a lunchbox full of food on his doorstep that he found on his way home. Someone else told me that they couldn't find their charger and then they found their charger. And, you know, so going, and there was a plug socket in the train and I've never seen those before. Yeah, that's not really, you know, so what I'm saying is, right, there's a kind of, I'm not saying that this thing that happened with Omen proves that magic works. I'm saying that I've done, like, every time I've done magic, I think except one time, I've got a result that I can put down as a positive. And I don't feel the need for anyone else to believe that. I don't know to what degree I believe it. That's another important thing. I just kind of go, cool, magic seems to work. What I mainly use magic now for is writing and exploring my own headspace rather than doing stuff in... There's something a bit kind of, I don't know, gauche about doing stuff in the real world.
Oh, well, I was going to say, I mean, this does sort of beg the next kind of blunt question. If you've got magic powers, why aren't you rich and or famous?
Because everyone's got magic powers.
But you are, but not everyone performs magic rituals.
I mean, I am rich, and I am relatively famous. So, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I am rich. In the grand scheme of things, I am wealthy. And an awful lot of my ability to produce wealth, i.e. earn money, comes from my magical practice.
But lots of... You say everyone has magic powers, but a small number of people actually perform magic rituals. So yeah. Isn't that the same as sort of if everyone could do it, then what does it mean?
Yeah, but everyone can do it, and what it means, and a lot of people are doing it. So people say, for example, you know, why don't you do magic to win the lottery? Okay, everyone else is doing that as well. Trust me. I see what you mean.
They might not be lighting candles and turning in circles, but they might be really wishing to win the lottery, and that amounts to the same thing. Is that what you mean? So isn't
all kind
magic
of
then the same
each other
as sort of hoping for something?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I don't give it any more weight than that. It's just hoping for something in a really specific, focused way.
Is this like what is Noel Edmonds? Does he write little things on his
Was that universal
on his hands? Cosmic ordering?
But you know, I don't think there's anything supernatural or unscientifically provable or investigatable about this stuff. You know this. The most positive people in the world seem to have better lives than people who are really
negative.
Definitely,
absolutely.
And if all magic is a way of turning yourself into a sort of optimistic person, then fine, that's the way it works.
That's the mechanism through which it works. Is it basically then sort of sexy religion?
Yeah.
Because it's not religion, it's not a set of beliefs. Are some people's religion simply a set of beliefs?
No, I'm saying that. Yeah, that's they are. But religion is what I mean. Religion comes from the same root as the word ligature. It means to bind together in one belief. Mm-hmm. That's what religion means. And that's these things are true. If you believe them, you are of that religion. If you don't believe them, you are not of that religion. That's what religion is. Whereas with magic, I've yet to meet someone who practices ritual magic that I agree with to the degree that my mate Al, who I did that Edinburgh show with, and I stopped doing magic together because he believes that the gods are real outside of human experience, and I believe that when humans die, all the gods die. So you know, it's. It's not a religion because it's not a set of beliefs, and it doesn't require, certainly that what I've got in my head doesn't require any faith. I've done loads of rituals, and every time I've done it, I've brought about, well, the thing I've wanted to make happen has happened. Now, and you know, Crowley will, if you read Crowley, he says you can't do stuff that's physically impossible. You can't cause an eclipse if an eclipse isn't going to happen. It's about, I think there's a kind of malleable edge to the universe that you can turn around. And things like NLP may well have exactly the same result. Cosmic ordering may well have the same result. But, you know, it's interesting that, because, you know, why aren't I rich and famous? Well, I am relatively famous. I keep getting people coming up to me going, "Are you famous?" Which is really weird. That's happened several times over the last six
That's
months.
Nicely paradoxical.
Are you famous? Obviously
why
not.
Why am I asking this question?
Yeah. And in terms of money, like I've got quite a lot of debt, but also by the same token, I've in world terms, I'm very rich. As of course we all are, but I'm doing sort of fine. And career wise, in terms of my life, I'm fantastically lucky.
So here's Andrew, ladies and gentlemen. You don't get many is he a Satan botherer? Is that a thing? You don't get many Satan bothering transvestite Doctor Who fan type comedians. Not least practitioners of magic, no doubt. I really appreciate Andrew having this conversation with me. He's someone I've known for a long time. I've really enjoyed gigging with Andrew. We were slightly confined by the live format. Now, I know some of you email me and say you prefer the non-live ones because we get into... Sometimes we get into more depth. Sometimes we can talk longer and choose different bits. And I know sometimes the pure hour format can prevent that, but I think at the same time there's really something to be said for doing it live, because it does give it a bit of a sense of joie de vivre and of fun, and maybe those can be more fun episodes as well. But I think we got some great stuff out of Andrew here, so thank you very much to him for coming along. Thank you to Mark Makin for having us at the Leamington Spa Comedy Festival. As you know, I myself am from Leamington Spa. I was born in Bristol, but I grew up in Leamington Spa, and that's the train platform sign that most makes me feel comfortable when I roll into it on a train. So thanks to everyone that listened there. Thanks to everyone that that came along, all of you. And yes, please, thank you again. I mean, these middle bits are primarily just thanks for the donations, but they are really very much appreciated. So please keep sending those in. Comedianscomedian.com. Simply click on the PayPal button on that website. Or you can, I have forgotten in recent episodes to mention Patreon, but at patreon.com/comcompod, if you are a user of the Patreon website, you can also pledge a small amount of money per show that presumably a couple of people have now signed up to. No, I mean, a couple of people have signed up to. Presumably, money has been changing hands. Maybe I've got to get in touch with those people and find out how that works. But if you want to do the more traditional route, PayPal, or just see me in the street or at a festival and stick a fiver in my back pocket. Coming up very soon now, the 22nd, of course, is the episode with Brendan Burns. That's going to be a live episode at 2:15 at the Lightbox at Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival. Brendan Burns is right of reply. He's going to be the second act to return to the podcast. And we're looking forward to that. So please grab a ticket for that. Google up how to achieve that. It's pay what you want, as ever. So you can take a risk and turn up free or secure a ticket for £5 in advance. And that is all for now. Let's get back to the very, very funny, very fascinating Andrew O'Neill.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Let's talk about your career. Let's talk about comedy. Where are you in comedy at the moment? What's going on for you at the moment?
I'm currently writing a Radio 4 show. I've got a 2-part Radio 4 show commissioned, which is about gender and sexuality. And I'm developing a TV show with in-house with the BBC, and I, you know, make a living doing tours. And I'm touring my History of Heavy Metal at the moment, and I, yeah, do club gigs. And I sort of I've always feel like I've got a foot in both camps, the kind of club comic camp and the sort of, you know, Edinburgh sort of art centre sort of camp. And I'm very happy being both, because I want to be a really reliable comic as well as being odd.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. So let's talk about how you started comedy then. How did you bring yourself to comedy? So you described before being a huge fan, hoovering up all these sort of influences.
Yeah.
What were the circumstances that led to your first gig?
I went to a lot of comedy with my ex. And do you remember Ivan's comedy gaff?
Yes, I do.
On Rathbone Place. Yeah, we used to go there a lot. And I remember saying to people at the time, it's brilliant. Like, the comedians outnumber the audience. It's great. And now that's like, you know, that's nightmare fuel. But, it was a great... And saw people like Paul Foote, who I just immediately thought was an utter genius. And saw Eddie Izzard live, saw Bill Bailey live. And I think at that point, I'd already been saying for like 2 years, maybe 3 years, I want to do comedy.
Were you a funny kid at that point?
It was the single most important thing. I didn't really care if people liked me or not, as long as they thought I was funny.
Okay.
And in social situations, I'm sure I was just, you know, intolerable. Just in any social situation, it would be I would just have to try and make everyone laugh.
What was your school life like? What sort of school did you go to? And were you dressed in black at the time? Were you like a young goth?
Well, probably been a metalhead since I was about 14. I was very lucky. I went to a boys' school, a grammar school, which is sort of like, you know, it's a state school, but you have to pass the 11 plus. And I had a really tight group of mates who I'm still friends with. John, Charlie, Dave, and Martin were the main four guys. And we were constantly trying to make each other laugh. And around the age of 15, 16, I started using my brother's camcorder to make films and sketches and stuff. A film of my mate Martin on the toilet just holding things up and then editing it. So we'd just go, sprocket and melon. And, you know, we found that hilarious. And it's the sort of thing that people do. I think now it's kind of YouTube would do it, but we were...
Pre-YouTube.
Yeah, very much pre-YouTube. And I've still got the videos and no one's ever seen them. So, yeah, so lots of sort of stupid sketches and stuff. And then I went to university because I did film studies at uni because I thought I wanted to be a filmmaker. And then it became obvious that it wasn't the filmmaking part of that was I was invested in. It was the comedy part. So, but yeah, I mean, Seinfeld, wasn't he? Everyone's funny when they're a teenager. And it's true, but that's because people play more when they're teenagers. You see teenagers dicking about on buses and stuff in a way that adults don't. But we do, it in comedy clubs and, you know. So, yeah, I have always considered myself really funny. And then I started doing comedy and realised it wasn't as funny as I thought.
Was that painful? How was that to sort of...
Well, my first...
When you say that as a kid, it was more important to you to be funny than to be liked.
Yeah.
So who is that kid? Why was it that you needed the laughs? And how did that feel like when you started and didn't get them?
I don't know. I just guess it was the thing I liked about myself was my ability to make people laugh. And, yeah, early on in stand-up, my first gig was really... So my first gig was... I booked in downstairs at the... I asked Ivan, how'd you get into this? And he said, do downstairs at the King's Head on a Thursday. So I booked that, and then I got impatient, and I dropped in at a Laughing Horse gig in Camden and said, can I get on tonight? And they said, oh, it's a competition. And I remember Alex Musson was on, Nina Conti was on, I can't remember who else, and they said, it's a competition, but you don't have to do the competition, we'll just stick you on. And I had about 5 minutes of material, and I did it in about 3 minutes. And I got laughs, and it was a really enjoyable
experience.
And this
was when you say people like Nina Conti, these are your contemporaries, they were also competing
at an
open
spot level. Yeah.
Okay.
And it was January the 16th, 2002. And I got laughs, and I got a round of applause, and I went away going, I can do this. And also, having been in bands for a long time at this point, I've been in hardcore punk bands, and I'm, you know, I've been a musician for a long time, and I have to work much harder at music than I do at comedy to get to like a kind of average level, I suppose. And I did that first gig and just went, right, yeah, this is it. And it was just really obvious that this is a thing I should do. And then my second gig, because I didn't do any work, I'm like, yeah, I can do this. And then my second gig at the King's Head.
I think that's a fairly common
second
pitfall.
Gig was dreadful. And also my second gig, I had a joke saying the reason that unemployment is so high within the zebra community is that they can't get jobs in supermarkets because they keep scanning themselves. And at the second gig I ever did, I was on second, this is King's Head, and the guy on first went, if they sold zebras in supermarkets, you wouldn't need to put a barcode on them.
Yeah.
And I thought... He couldn't possibly have seen me do that joke and then do it then, which has actually given me the lesson ever since then of actually people usually aren't ripping you off on purpose. It is usually a coincidence. But yeah, and then so I went, oh, right, I've got to drop that joke. And then I kind of panicked and then I went on and died on my ass. But I had a few booked in then and I kept going. And then I think the next one was quite good and then the next one was terrible. And I spent about 2 or 3 years working out how to do comedy the way I want to do it and be... for kind of reliable at it.
Okay.
It took me a long time.
What's different about your style now compared to what it was then? Is it just you're saying that the influences are less apparent?
Yeah, like, it's definitely more me now.
Do you have any gags now that you've held on to for years? Have you got any old favourites that were good enough then that have stayed with you?
I've got a little bag of bankers that I keep on my belt. And probably the oldest joke I still do would be just stuff about getting shouted at. Because I used to have bright red hair, and I had matured about that. And you know, I've often encountered aggression on the street for my appearance. Less as I get older, I found, but or possibly just doing this better. That's another element to it. But yeah, so probably the "Oi mate, you look like a fucking woman." And then me replying, fuck me, your mum must be ugly. That's, I remember when I came up with that and I'm like, oh, this is good. Cause that means that when they're sat there thinking I look weird, I can acknowledge that I know I do.
Yes.
Which is, which is such 101, but I never did a comedy course and wasn't taught the formula. You know, I used to do a joke of, I know what you're thinking, Richard O'Brien's let himself go. And the joke being, I look nothing like Richard O'Brien, but unfortunately the audience don't know that that's a joke that I'm subverting.
That is one of, I think that is one of the chief things that I get frustrated watching open spots do. And I've seen newer comics preface a joke about what they look like a takeoff of the concept of a joke about what they look like by explaining what a lot of comics do.
Oh,
is
amazing.
They come on and they do a joke about who they look like.
Wow.
Right, everyone got that? This is my joke about how I look like and how it's different to that.
I was
that.
Thinking the other day about how much information have I gleaned only from hearing it within stand-up. Because I've got a joke at the moment about when Jeremy Beadle's tiny little hand makes it feel like he's getting a hand job from someone far away. And it's in a list of facts. And it's sort of incidental, and it doesn't really matter how well it goes, because it's in a list of a load of things. But I don't think I've ever heard of that. The concept of using your left hand to have a wank so it feels like someone else is doing it, or sitting on your hand till it goes numb. I'm not sure I've ever heard a reference to that outside of stand-up comedy.
That's a really interesting
but
point.
But I've been doing stand-up for 12 and a half years, and I've been obsessed with stand-up for about 20 years. So a huge amount of my information comes
from comedy. Absolutely. I think a lot of my political attitudes come from watching alternative comedians in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
There are certain kind of core values I won't ever be able to let go of, in the same way that I could never wear flares.
Right,
because
yes,
I grew up
sure.
in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
Similarly,
absolutely.
I could never vote Tory because I grew up in the 80s.
Yeah.
And that's my kind of political consciousness was programmed there, largely by what I was hearing in comedy clubs. So that's, well, if let's take that as an example then. If you are taking in a lot of information from comedians,
yeah,
what does it mean to you to be alternative? If you're an alternative comedian, what does that mean to you when you exist as a comedy fan inside a world where being a comedian isn't an alternative? It's a base level.
For me, it's just the label for the sort of comedy I like, and it's always the other way around. It's always I don't give a shit if what I do is alternative or not, as long as I'm doing the sort of comedy I would want to watch as an audience member. That's 100% my goal. I want to be what would be my favourite comedian, and that entirely comes from my sort of subcultural, like being a metalhead. You know, there's no, why would I've never understood why anyone would make music that isn't exactly what they would most want to hear, which is why I don't understand boy bands, or, you know, because you think out of every boy band, how many of them actually really love pop music and how many of them just want to be kind of famous? Anyway, blah, blah, blah. Pop music in general, cynical corporate music in general. So with comedy, I've always liked the weirder stuff most, although I liked all sorts of comedy. I've got a Monty Python, not Monty Python, a Comic Relief joke book the Big Red Joke Book, which they missed a trick because there's Monty Python's Big Red Book. They should have made it a different colour. Anyway, so there's a load of jokes that are just really ordinary, and then there's the second to last section says jokes that are dodgy, and then the last one is jokes that should never be told. And the jokes that should never be told are the ones that only 1 in 10 people will ever get. You know, and at school, they would be the ones that I'd be armed with. So, like, really annoying jokes, like a woman with a banana in her ear gets onto a bus, and the bus driver says, "Excuse me, madam, did you know you've got a banana in your ear?" And she says, "I'm terribly sorry, I can't hear you, I've got a banana in my ear." Right? And when I was at school, if someone liked that sort of comedy, they were generally my sort of person.
Yes, yes, okay. So go on.
And so that's pretty much been my... Still, my goal is to be the sort of comic I would most like to see. And looking at my fans now, people who come to my solo shows, people who are big fans of what I do, it's totally like looking at the sort of person I would have been if I'd never been a comic.
That's interesting, because I wondered, listening to and watching your stuff, I wondered to what extent your alternativeness, and in terms of your act, your appearance, your transvesticism... Yeah, yeah. All of that stuff. I wonder how much of it how much of it are you going towards something, and how much of it is you moving away from something? How much of it is you wanting? Is you liking specifically metal, and how much of it is you liking being different to all the other people, all the normal people?
Yeah, it's funny that, because it's something I've done quite a lot of thinking about recently. I've done a lot of I'm an awful lot of things. I'm vegan. I'm a transvestite. I'm a metalhead. My politics
are
anarchist.
You're ticking the shit out of those boxes.
Yeah, yeah.
Aren't you?
And none of it is an effort to be different for the sake of being different. It's
none of it at all.
Literally none of it. It's entirely. I went vegan because I was just entirely convinced by the arguments I was hearing. I like metal because it just stirs my soul. I dress the way I do because it feels wrong and weird to not dress the way I do. I would far rather never get shit on the street for what I wear. I would far rather there were more people dressed weird in whatever way on the street, so it took attention off me. It's just that I've got the sort of personality where I care less what other people think. And in terms of the way I present myself, like on stage, it's always been a bit of a battle. I didn't cross dress on stage for years. I came out to training when I was 19 and didn't start comedy till I was 22. And I didn't cross dress on stage for about 3 years because I knew it would be something I'd have to talk about, something I'd have to overcome. So it wasn't until I essentially sort of did my apprenticeship and built my tools to cope with it. And now, weirdly, when I do the rowdier the gig, the better I do when I'm cross-dressed, because otherwise they look at me and think, he's weird and I can't put my finger on it. If I'm wearing skinny jeans and a bullet belt and eyeliner, it's not enough for them to go, alternative looking person, you know. But if I go on wearing a dress, they can immediately hang it on that. Oh, he's a transvestite. And then I can address that, get it out of the way, and then do my jokes.
Okay. So does that mean that in certain circumstances when you wouldn't specially fancy dressing as a woman on that day for that gig, you end up dressing, no, I don't mean as a woman, but dressing in female clothes, you end up dressing like that almost tactically?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
That's quite interesting. Does that mean that it's because that then you are dressing according to other people's reactions rather than purely for yourself?
Yeah, but that's also part of getting the job done effectively.
Okay.
In much the same way that an actor will go on stage wearing a certain thing, you know, But
you see, that strikes me as weird because it seems that, and you said that you don't care what other people think. So do you not feel that you're kind of conforming because you're having to present a certain version of your alternative?
Not caring about what people think is different from not caring whether or not I do well at a gig.
No, absolutely, absolutely.
And I will do what's necessary to, and to the degree, again, with that if I'm bombing, I will change tack and do straighter stuff because I'm a professional stand-up comedian and my job is to make people laugh. And if I'm not getting them, I don't just put my head down and plough the furrow. Because I've always wanted to be the sort of comic that can go out and have any audience in stitches.
Yeah,
and you know,
do you feel then? Do you ever think do you ever feel that your desire to be able to play any room or whatever, to be able to get laughs from any audience, does that clash with your respect for that audience? Because there must be in certain rooms there must be, you might play a room that is full of the sort of, or contains some of the sort of people that would shout shit at you in the street.
100%.
And there you are tap dancing away trying to make them laugh in order to go, I've achieved my goal of being a comedian.
But there's also there's a wonderful feeling of getting those dudes on board with what I do. And the single best example of that ever was when I did Baby Blue in Liverpool. Must have been 5 years ago, and it was a hostile crowd, a really like dressed up Liverpool Saturday night. The women dressed like way more like drag queens than I would ever look, you know, like proper shimmery, massive hair, loads of makeup, amazing shoes. The guys all in short sleeve shirts, jeans, and smart shoes, all with shaved heads, walking in, looking at me with disdain as they walk in. And then I went up on stage and did my weird stand up wearing a dress. And won them over. And then there was literally, on this one occasion, a small queue after the show of Scouse blokes wanting to go, we walked in, we weren't sure, but like, they was all right, fella, you're funny. And they were like, and the satisfaction of being able to be who I am and being able to be as odd as I am and have them go, oh, okay, I get it. No, you're all right, actually.
Yeah.
Is a cool thing to be able to do. And yeah, if I wasn't doing comedy, I wouldn't have that, you know, that requirement to get them on board. Like with my band, if people don't like my band, I'm not going to do anything different about it to win them over. Mm. But with comedy, I will, out of the jokes I've written, for which are all still my jokes, they're all still me. I haven't got any jokes, I'll never do a joke I don't like. So it's just a case of using that one rather than that one and then getting them on board. And then usually when I've got them on board, I can go a bit weirder anyway.
What areas of comedy are there that you feel you want to have more of a grasp on? If there's certain areas within which you go, yep, I've got that nailed, I'm expressing myself how I want to like that. What other what things do you wish you were better at doing?
Politics. I've always felt that... Because my stand-up is generally really silly. And my political views... My political views are quite extreme from as far as most people's sensibilities are concerned. Yeah, I am an anarchist. I do fundamentally believe that the state is one of the... You know, the state and concentrations of power, whether that's corporate or whatever, you know, are harmful. And that stuff is so far outside of the normal debate that it's very hard to be funny about it. Like, to be properly funny about it without selling it out to any degree.
And have you tried? Have you attempted to do that?
Early on, but it was all, early on it was always just a kind of, you know, I'd talk at length about politics in detail and then I'd undercut it with, you know, that's 50p, please, mate, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a very sort of, you know, talking about dense subjects in comedy 101 thing. You know, Bill Bailey does it very, very well. Russell Brand does it with a bit more flair, but... Beyond that, I don't know, it's quite tricky because I think with genuinely making political points, what you essentially have to do is you have to show the audience an idea that they might not necessarily disagree with and might not necessarily agree with, and then show them that they're actually wrong or that you are right while making them laugh. So, blah, 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 this is why the Tories are crap, and have you ever looked at it like this? Oh, yeah, and that will usually be what causes a laugh. But for me, I'm like, yeah, your guys are all having the wrong argument. It's not left versus right, it's power versus no power, you know. And you need about half an hour of explanation before you can even get a handle on what my politics are anyway. Noam Chomsky talks about this a lot. He doesn't do telly very much because telly works in sound bites. What he has to say isn't part of the dominant narrative. So, you know, he nearly always starts with, but the argument we should be having isn't whether or not we should bomb Iraq. It's, you know, the whole geopolitical situation around our ownership of stuff in the Middle East. You know, look at it from outside the box. So yeah, and I think anyone listening at home will now have a really clear idea of why of how I don't make politics funny. And you know, I do a bit of it. I do like a little bit of stuff about veganism and a little bit of stuff about probably all my politics now will be gender stuff. And basically, pretty much going and wearing a dress and going, "This is all right, isn't it?" And people go, "Actually, yeah, I suppose it is." And that's a lot easier because the arguments are just really easy. You know, why can't men wear skirts? Oh yeah, no, you're right. Because it's like with homophobia. If transphobia and homophobia, if you shine a light on it, it just withers and dies. Almost no one who's homophobic is genuinely against people being gay. They are just shoring up the cultural norms and in order to gain status or you know, whatever. But if you actually say, "But what is actually wrong with it?" And they'll go, "Oh, well, you know, God says it's wrong." Okay, well, if we blow that argument out of the water, what's still wrong with it? I don't know. Mm. And they're just reinforcing cultural norms. So it's really, really easy to get people on board with cross-dressing. You just go, "What's wrong with it?" And they can't tell you. And then you go, "See." But if you tell people what's wrong with the state, well, you know...
Is there a mid-ground? Is there somewhere that... I mean, are you planning to move into those areas?
No? Not really, because... I don't know. I'm currently watching Russell Brand doing it and getting annoyed at him.
From what perspective?
Oh, just stop fucking telling people what to do politically when you've spent almost your entire career making shit pop culture and becoming a millionaire. It's like, it's not your place. Don't sell a book for 20 quid telling people not to be capitalists.
Yeah.
If he just needs to get his ego out the equation. You know, if you found out he was giving millions to the Green Party on the quiet, you go, "Oh, nice one," you know, but going, "Look at me, everyone, I've got the solution." Everyone goes, "What is it, Russell?" He goes, "I don't know, but this is wrong, isn't it?" "Well, yeah, obviously, we've been saying this for ages, but now you're making yourself more famous as a result." He's putting his ego in front of it. It's really frustrating. I knew Russell early on and we talked about politics when he just got out of rehab. And he saw me talking about doing that rubbish material on anarchism. And he said, "We shall be friends." And we used to have lunch. And then I had a go at him for doing Big Brother's Big Mouth. So why are you doing a show like that? Big Brother is awful, and it's part of the toxic culture that people have been spoon fed. You went, Andrew, I just need to be, because he does, one of those people uses your name a lot, Stuart. You know what I mean? And he said, Andrew, I just need to be famous. I went, all right, okay, bye then. Off you go, marry Katy Perry.
So was he off your sort of friend list then?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No. Absolutely not. He just got very famous and I guess very busy and went off on his own direction. But
coming back to your direction and what you want out of comedy.
Yeah.
Do you, because you've kind of nailed your colours to the wall in terms of being alternative.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've appeared on Stuart Lee Presents.
Yeah.
And you're sort of recognised as you're apart from a lot of other comics.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you do something that was more mass? Like if Live at the Apollo came to you and asked you to be on that, would you be on that?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, no question. I do find it sometimes frustrating in my career that my biggest aim is to be successful at doing comedy, you know, and being a really good comic and being a reliable comic. And the alternative thing, although it's given me a lot of advantages, as often, like, you know, when I've done bits of telly, metalheads and goths and punks will go, oh, look, it's one of us. And you know, there's a little subcultural shortcut and they're more likely to listen to what I have to say and probably more likely to become fans of mine as a result. The flip side of that is things like I was literally told I was too weird to do McIntyre's Roadshow.
Okay.
And it's the frustration of that is, yeah, but I'm... What the single thing I'm best at in life is making rooms for the people laugh, and I'm quite reliable at it. But it's like a category thing. I know you're one of the alternative ones. You're more like, I think they're thinking you're more like him. You're more like him. But actually, I think if you cut through what I look like and what I'm talking about, I'm still just doing jokes, and I'm still just trying to find ways of being funny. The other stuff is just that I happen to be a massive weirdo in most people's eyes. I'm still wearing clothes that I buy from shops. You know what I mean? I'm not painting myself green and walking down the road naked. I'm just...
Could you... Oh, I mean, which is most important to you? Kind of success as a comic or self-expression through comedy? Like, if they said to you, okay, you can come on the Apollo, but you've got to wear a suit so we can't see your tattoos.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that.
So you wouldn't make any concession to it?
No. Well, there's no, because I don't see any point. That would be a Pyrrhic victory. That wouldn't be me being the comic I want to be. So yeah, I would be relatively content to poodle along at the level I'm at now, and not have those big successes if it
meant that you could do it on your terms.
Yeah, yeah, but I don't believe it works like that. I actually think that long term, having a commitment to your own vision. God, there we go, sounding pretentious now. Having a commitment, but genuinely having a commitment to your own vision, as long as you're realistic about the bottom line is you've got to make people laugh, which is, I'm always very conscious of, then I think actually, long term, it's a better way of going about things. And I think, there's a thing, isn't it? Where, like, it seems that the way the telly end of things works is they approach the people who are most interesting. And the people who do very well in Edinburgh are often the most interesting people, quite often the most alternative. Like, you know, Sam Wills, the boy with tape on his face, is a really good example of this. Oh, what you did is brilliant. We've never seen anything like this. And then they tried to develop a show with him and then kept going, yeah, no, that's too weird. We're never going to sell that. Well, why did you go and approach him? Why instead don't you go to the weekend clubs and find the everyman comics who are really good craftsmen and get them to make your fucking TV show? Because if what you want is something we can sell to the masses, there's tons of comics you should be putting on telly. But if you want someone who's got genuinely original, interesting ideas, don't take them and then squeeze them through a different shaped Play-Doh mold. Like, yeah, We Are Clang, who live were one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. Mm. Their TV show was rubbish, really rubbish, and it was like they just knocked all the corners off it. And what I wish would happen more often is what happened with Vic Reeves' Big Night Out, which is, what you do is really good, tell us what you want to do with it, and we'll make it, because that was really good. We'll give you 6 half-hours, 11 o'clock on Channel 4, just do that, and get the best people in the industry to take that vision and put it on telly. Paul Foote should be given 6 half-hours, and just do it, just even if it's just once, you know? But it always there always seems to be this really weird circular route where you become more, you become better at being an interesting comic, and then telly gets you, and then they push you back towards doing something that's acceptable by the mainstream. And comics wouldn't have gone on that journey. They would never have got the telly if they'd just wanted to be reliably funny. And I say just, there's you know, some of my favourite comics are people who aren't particularly interesting in terms of their style or content. They're just really, really good. Bob Mills is a proper down-the-line 90s alternative comic, and he's the funniest person I've ever seen doing stand-up. And, you know, and then Brian Gittins, who's incredible, they can't find a vehicle for him. When instead, all they should be doing is, right, let's make something. It's a really odd. It's a really odd circular route, and I'm about, it feels like I'm about to embark on having those arguments myself. Yes. I'm starting to develop.
Because now
a thing.
You're developing stuff yourself, and you're feeling like you're going to need to fight for it.
I've already had one argument on that. Just kind of okay. Well, we won't make it quite like that. Which, you know, I think if you work with good people like Alison, who I'm doing my radio thing with, I think what I expected from BBC Radio 4 was. Well, we can't do that. The only thing I'm not allowed to do is swear, really. Everything else is up for grabs. The stylistic things I'm doing, she's going, oh, yeah, cool, that'd be great. Mm. And she's also, you know, the feedback she's given me is spot on. Remember when I worked with Coogan? the 32 seconds I was on screen in Saxondale. Just listening to him and the director working through stuff and just going, these guys really know how comedy works.
Yeah.
Talking about having to trump a previous, you know, well, if you do that, the next joke you do has got to trump that one. And just talking about the mechanics on it on such a high level. And I just feel like, I don't know, everyone says TV should be braver, don't they? Everyone says that. But I think it's because it's true. I think it's because comics work for years at working out how to be funny. And then people who don't make comedy tell them that they don't know how to be funny.
Yeah.
And I think you probably get a lot of shit that way, but it's almost like everyone that's got a really, really good show will be able to make at least an hour's worth of good comedy for the telly.
Before we finish then, I just wanted to ask you about your strategy with stuff like releasing material online.
Oh, yeah.
With releasing stuff, you're putting entire shows up on YouTube or on Bandcamp. Have you put something?
Yeah.
Are you selling shows? How has that been? What's that experience from a sort of technical point of view?
It's pretty good.
Because that's obviously something that you've got artistically complete control over.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's interesting because partly I've now got sort of two shows in the can that I'm waiting to put up, and I'm sort of like, you watch The Cult Comedian to research this. I'm sort of going, oh yeah, but that's so old now. Mm. It's good, and I really like having stuff up there, you know, because when I was watching Eddie Izzard around my mate's house and telling people, you have to watch this, you know, that's, it's nice to be in a position where I now have people come out and going, me and my mates watch alternative regularly. Mm. And okay, that's cool, that's also a bit odd, but it's nice. But also the other thing it does is it forces me to write more material and yeah, sort of turn stuff over. But there's also, I think, there's my music mentality of with Edinburgh shows, I wish I'd done it with all of them from the start, but because I've done like 11 solo shows now. With a band, you've got albums, and even if they're a bit, your early albums are a bit crap, they're out there. Mm. And it's like an artifact. Mm. And with comedy, it's so much more ephemeral. I mean, you know, if you could watch every We Are Clang Edinburgh show that was just recording, even if it was just recording on a camcorder, it would be amazing. You know, Pappy's as well, Pappy's Fun Club, as they once were. You know, that would be, I think everyone should do that. And so, yeah, it's just, you know, putting it up there, hoping people enjoy it. And it's interesting with A Cult Comedian, I did it in seven chunks. By coincidence.
I know, I downloaded all of them and ripped the audio from all of them.
Yeah,
and had
to put
them in a
row. Yeah.
It's really annoying.
And that was, that's what's interesting is watching the viewer count go down.
I noticed that. Obviously, some people are going to start watching it and not stick with it. A lot of people are going to start watching it and see.
Can you remember how many are on the
episode
like one?
6,000 by the end.
Yeah, but can you remember how many are at the beginning?
I can't remember
because it drops. I think most people just watch a bit of the first one, and then quite a lot of people watch one and two, and then it drops quite sharp. But it's the online attention span. Yeah. And also alternative.
And it's still by the end, that's still 6,000 people who saw your show compared to what? An Edinburgh room of 50 people over 26 nights.
Yeah. And I think alternative has had something like 50,000 views now, but I don't know how much, because that's like an hour and three quarters long.
So there might have been 49,000 people watched the first 10 minutes.
Yeah. But it's good, and I like getting stuff out that way. The metal show, which I'm currently doing, I'm probably not going to record for a long time, because I want to be able to tour that indefinitely, really. I've just done that with a live band, and it was an incredible experience.
Listen, we must wrap up, because you've got to run to a gig, but just tell me about the metal show, because that's still touring at the moment.
Heroes for Metal is still on tour. I wrote it just with me, me, a guitar and a laptop, and so I...
It literally is
a history of heavy metal, and I start at the beginning and I go through to the present day, and then
with jokes,
with actual jokes. Yeah, it's probably the funniest thing I've written. And then I said, well, I clearly have to do this with the band, so I got my mates who are in a death metal band called Reprisal, and they learned, I taught them the songs, and we did it at the Highbury Garage in front of 340 people, and it was just superb. And so we're going to tour that show. Going to do it in all the metal festivals.
With the band,
yeah. Do all the metal festivals. Going to do it at the garage again in Easter. And it was cool because, again, it's like, I wrote that show with my mum in mind. Every joke I wrote, I thought, if my mum can, I'm going to write this with a view to my mum understanding it. Because people come up and go, I didn't even like metal and I like that show. And I'm slightly getting bored of going, yes, that's the point. But it is. It's a show for people. It's a show for people that don't like metal.
And it's a show to convert people's mums.
Yeah, but if you do like metal, you will probably like it five times as much. And there's literally one joke in it that I then have to explain after the laugh has died, because it's a joke about Dave Mustaine from Megadeth. But then what I do is I go, I don't want to leave anyone behind. But I don't know. I guess I'm probably an alternative comic who's got a sort of slightly mainstream sensibility. Because like Bill Bailey is really, really, his comedy is weird, and he is weird, and he's huge. And Eddie Izzard, mind you, I think I used to think Eddie Izzard was more alternative than he actually is. But when he came along, we were like, no one does that. Monty Python is huge, and Monty Python is incredibly difficult at its best. Not the shit they did in the live show, but I've done a lot of hitchhiking, and people would always go, oh, I'll tell you what I love, mate, like truck drivers, tell you what I love, mate, Monty Python, oh, I love, they've got all their tapes, yeah, and Roy Chubby Brown as well, like him as well, and about five different people went, I love Python, I think the accessibility of weird comedy is massively underrated.
That's a perfect point to leave it. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for coming.
So that was Andrew. Thanks very much to him for coming along. Thanks to Mark for having us at the Leamington Spa Comedy Festival. That's all for now. I will be back in the UK before you know it. And do remember to come and see not only the live podcast with Brendan Burns at 2:15 p.m. at the Lightbox at Dave Lester Comedy Festival on Sunday the 22nd of February, but also later that same day, let's say 8 o'clock, it might be 7, if you're going to look into it, you'll find out what it is. I'm going to be doing my new work in progress show, provisionally entitled Stick to Your Guns, so come and see that. I have definitely got some jokes now, and it's all going to be fine. Thanks a lot. I'll speak to you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.